Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I am pleased tonight to be able to introduce my colleague Victoria Lemley Beckner, an educator, researcher, clinician focused on the study and practice of psychotherapy. Victoria is an assistant clinical professor at UCSF. She's a partner in private practice at the San Francisco Group for Evidence-Based Psychotherapy, a group that's committed to the integration of science and practice in psychotherapy. Victoria is a very accomplished researcher. She has published innumerable papers on psychotherapy for depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder. And she also is very interested in an understanding of how psychotherapy might work in the integration of psychological factors and underlying changes in the brain that might be involved. Her research in that area includes a three-year fellowship at UCSF studying neuroendocrine effects of stress on brain lesions and symptoms in multiple sclerosis. Victoria has taught on psychotherapy everywhere from UCSF to the University of Rwanda. She's been involved in training psychologists, psychiatrists in those places, has led innumerable workshops and seminars. She is the lead author on a book on the psychotherapeutic treatment of trauma, Conquering Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. And what makes it a real treat to introduce Victoria for this talk is not only her passion for the science of psychotherapy, but also her passion for the personal way in which psychotherapy changes lives. So without further ado, Victoria Beckner.
So thank you, Cannon, very much for that lovely introduction. So it's delightful to be here tonight. I was really excited to be invited to give this talk. I will say that when I asked what the topic was, and they told me the topic was psychotherapy, that I was somewhat intimidated by the breadth and scope of that topic. And what do you talk about for an hour and a half on the enormous, enormous topic of psychotherapy? So I polled some of my colleagues and friends. I asked my mom, what would you want to hear? Some of mom's suggestions got into the talk. And actually, it was a fun process, and putting this talk together was an enormous and educational experience for me. So I've kind of pulled from the research in a lot of different areas to really take on and ask, and sometimes answer, sometimes not, some of the big questions about psychotherapy. So some of those big questions are, and this will be how I will organize my talk tonight, psychotherapy, who needs it? And one of the things I just want to say from the outset is I'm a huge advocate of psychotherapy for everyone. And it's not just because I make my living at it. I'm a believer. And, you know, hopefully by the end of the talk, you'll see why. Okay. What exactly is psychotherapy? You got to admit, like, even those of you who've been in psychotherapy, it's kind of a mystery, right? Like, what's going on in that room? And so even though there are a variety of different approaches to psychotherapy, there are common things that we are trying to do. And I want to just give a very brief overview of that, just to sort of do what my mom said I needed to do, which was to define psychotherapy. So advocating for psychotherapy, saying what it is, you know, the big question is, does it work? And, I can tell you right now, unequivocally, tremendous amount of research, psychotherapy is hugely effective. That's the good news. The question about what makes it work is actually not nearly as clear. We know that it works. We know a lot about a lot of treatments. But the research into exactly how psychotherapy works and what makes it work, we've got some preliminary, we have some data. I'm going to present that tonight. But it's a question that is an ongoing passion of mine. So let's start with psychotherapy. Who needs it? So I just wanted to give a snapshot of the prevalence of psychological disorders in the United States. The first bar right here, this is a lifetime prevalence rate. So what that means is somewhere between 45 and 50% of the adult population at some time, if they walked in and were and saw somebody to assess them, would be diagnosed with some type of mental disorder. The second bar here is just the 12-month prevalence rate. So in any given year, it's still a pretty large portion. So sitting here today, a third of the people would actually meet criteria for some disorder. Children is a little closer to about 13%. This is also a 12-month prevalence rate. So this is probably not a surprise, but the most common disorders that we see in private practice and really are the mood disorders, which include, which most of the people come and have depression. The other mood disorders include the bipolar disorders. Anxiety disorders as a group, actually you see more people with anxiety even than depression. Substance use disorders is probably the largest group. And then I just wanted to list here some of the other common disorders, not quite the, you know, what we see as often, but this just gives you a feel for kind of what people are struggling with. Just want to give you a snapshot also of disorders for kids. You can see that, again, mood disorders and anxiety disorders are really quite common, and then ADHD is also one of the most common disorders for kids. So it's not just mental disorders that actually, you know, are an issue here. Even if you are one of the lucky 50% who never actually comes down with a disorder, every person in this room has and will experience significant life stressors. So, you know, the big categories are, you know, loss of a significant relationship through death or divorce or breakup, life-changing events, role-changing events, retiring, getting married. Relationship problems are a really big issue. We get a lot of people to come into therapy with relationship problems. A lot of people don't, but we have a lot to offer there. And health problems end up being a major stressor. So you know, what I want to say is that, you know, between disorders and stress, I think that there's a big place for psychotherapy. And both of these really do take a major life toll. So certainly there's a psychological toll in the emotional pain, in the impairment that's caused, the loss of work, productivity, school, grades dropping. And in sort of a bigger scheme, you know, when we're really struggling with something, our dreams are really put on hold. You know, we're in survival mode. So there's this huge psychological toll. But there is also a large physiological toll. And so one of the themes of tonight's talk is that mind and body are connected. And when we're suffering psychologically, there's also physiological correlates. So you've probably all heard about the research on depression and heart disease and also mortality after heart attack. So this is just showing that post-discharge after a heart attack, those people who are very low on a measure of depression actually have a pretty good survival rate. But those who are scoring in the moderate to severe range of depression, when they are discharged, this is their survival rate. So it just, you know, it's like it has a physical cost as well. And a big part of that has to do with a lot of the disorders and just regular stressors activate the stress alarm system, which is called the HPA system, hypothalamic, pituitary axis. And Basically, what happens is that when you're stressed, the brain releases a series of hormones to release cortisol. Adrenaline is also released. These are designed to actually activate the body to cope with the stress. But over time, when you see chronic stress, you get all kinds of problems. So just a couple of examples. We have a researcher here, researchers here that look at stress, cortisol, and aging, and this is a study by Alyssa Eppel, and what she's showing basically is, so a marker of aging is the ends of your DNA have telomeres, and over time, as you age, those telomeres get shorter. Well, guess what? Stress accelerates that. That's what this study shows. And this is a study done by my mentor, David Moore, and he's just showing that people who have multiple sclerosis, those who have significant work and relationship stress, 8 weeks later are more likely to show, these are called gadolinium-enhanced MRI lesions. It's basically brain inflammation. It's what causes the exacerbations and the symptoms in MS. So again, another example. That when we have disorders, when we have stress, it doesn't just have a psychological toll, but it also has a physical toll. So, I think that there are some of us in our generation who are pretty gung-ho for therapy, but of course, I would say that there's a large part of the population who, there's still stigma associated, and the attitude is, I'm coping fine, I don't need professional help. And, I think that's true. You know, I think most of us can get through most of life's hardships. But what I would say is that, we do cope, but we cope in this very automatic and conscious way. And we learn to cope from our experience and what some of our natural coping strategies are. But, they're not always the most helpful or effective way to cope. And in fact, sometimes another term for them are defenses. And so there can be a cost in how we're coping, and there isn't really a conscious choice around how we're coping with these things. Well, how do you learn to cope better? How do you develop some kind of conscious choice around what would be the best way to cope? What I would say is we kind of need some courses on this. I'm surprised it's not required at school and at work and everywhere else. How do you cope with stress? How do you have a healthy relationship? Emotions 101, thriving through life. I mean, these are things that are not taught. So we're just winging it when it comes to coping with our problems. And so what I'd like to say is psychotherapy has something to offer to really step in and fill that gap. Okay, psychotherapy. What the heck is it? So in the broadest sense, psychotherapy is designed, usually what brings people into psychotherapy is some distress. They're struggling with symptoms. They're struggling with something in their life. But psychotherapy also has a lot to offer on the positive side for healthy behaviors, well-being, for defining our values and really creating a meaningful life. So actually, it can do a lot. There are different modalities. There's individual, couples, and family, group psychotherapy. There's therapy with kids and adolescents and adults. There are many professionals who do psychotherapy. These are sort of the main categories that you see. Psychologists get a doctorate. That's what I am. And our training is not just in how to do psychotherapy or clinical practice. We do a lot of training in the causes of disorders. We get a lot of training in research, and we get a lot of training, and we do a lot of work on assessment of disorders and symptoms. Psychiatrists have an MD. They're the ones who can prescribe medication, and during their residency, they also get training in psychotherapy. And then the master's levels, the big categories, at least here in California, are social MSWs and MFTs. They get intensive two-year training and then additional hours, a year or two of additional hours in psychotherapy, different approaches. Social work also gets, they look at broader system level stuff as well. So, you know, in the realm of mental disorders, you know, the psychiatrists are going to be able to prescribe medication. Psychotherapy is the cure that's not the medication. It's commonly called the talking cure. But really, it's a lot more than talking. And the way that I think about it is it's a form of learning. And some of it can be learning through knowledge and education and insight, but a lot of it is experiential learning. And in many approaches, it's not just what happens in the session. There's also a lot of learning outside of the session. So I think everyone here is probably pretty familiar with the fact that there are many, many, many schools or approaches to psychotherapy. You may, if you've been in psychotherapy, you know, you may have known what that was. The therapist may have told you, you may not, but there are some pretty different approaches. Just to give you an idea of some of the big schools here, these are sort of some of the big categories, but as I said, there are many others. And one of the ways to think about the different approaches or schools is that each are based on a different theoretical model about what causes the problems, what causes the disorders, what gets people stuck, and then what are the curative factors in psychotherapy? How do we change things to address those problems? And so each of these schools have their own models and their own techniques that are designed to try to address that. And I'll say a little bit more here and there about them, but this is an entire semester class on this topic. It's I just wanted to kind of make you aware and to say, you know, in the field, the sort of psychodynamic, this is probably the most common approach in the Bay Area. If you go to see a therapist, they're probably psychodynamic or humanistic. That's probably who you're going to see. And in the psychodynamic tradition, there's a big emphasis on insight, understanding the origin of your problems, and that is a big part of the curative factor in psychotherapy, but also working with the therapy relationship. Behavior therapy, as you might imagine, focuses a lot on how do behaviors get shaped and developed and how do we actively change behavior. Cognitive therapy came in and said, hey, beliefs and thoughts are an important part of this process and have a big effect on how we feel and what we actually do. So cognitive behavioral therapy sort of combined these traditions. We've got a whole third wave of behavioral therapies that are actually newer, and they tend to emphasize both the behavioral tradition, active behavior change, but also rather than cognitive therapy, which is about identifying and changing your thoughts, they emphasize mindfulness, which is becoming aware and disengaging from your thoughts. And then there are many others. Interpersonal emotion focus would be really, really working, zeroing in on the emotion in the room and really working with that. And so these are some of the just very quick ways to think about some of these different models. But what I want to say, and in the next few slides here, you know, continuing with this, what is psychotherapy, is I want to say that there's a tremendous amount of overlap in the different approaches. And in fact, research suggests that many of the common factors across approaches are what's really helpful. So I just want to give a feeling for that. So these are some of the ways in which we work with clients in the room. These are our tools. Different approaches emphasize different tools more or less, but this is what's happening in the room. So I think if you have been in therapy, one of the things that you recognize is that the relationship between you and your therapist is a pretty unique relationship. And in some ways, you can often come in and talk about things in a way that you might not be able to talk to your family or friends. And a big part of what makes psychotherapy, you know, unique and different, and a big part of what we're actively working to do, is to help people really feel understood, to create a safety and a bond that allows them to really open up about their, I say up here, their shadows, but it's like our fears, our weaknesses, the things we feel ashamed about, the things we don't want to talk about. We sort of bring that out into the light, and in the reflection of the therapist who is holding a space and really trying to empathize and understand and give you unconditional positive regard and value, is pretty transformative. And it enables people to take emotional risks with their therapists that they may not make with other people in their life. And actually, this is a new behavior, and this is a new experience, and this is part of the way people learn. And so sometimes we talk about the corrective experience in psychotherapy through the therapeutic relationship. So therapeutic relationship or therapeutic alliance doesn't just include that bond. And this is important because there's actually a lot of research on therapeutic alliance, so I do want to define it. It's also a sense of shared goals, conceptualization of the problem, and the plan. So the client comes in with, you come in with your goals and your values, and then we do an assessment. Do you have a disorder? What are the problems? What are the origin of the problems? What's maintaining it? What are your strengths and weaknesses? What's your coping style? We're putting together what we know, say, about if you have depression. You know, I have a lot of hypotheses about why, you know, what's going on there, but I'm putting it together with the individual and what you want in therapy. And part of what my job is, and this is part of what builds alliance, is that you and I have to be on the same page. Are we on the same page for understanding what's causing the problem and what's the way through? So part of the therapy alliance is agreement on this. In CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy. Behavioral therapy is one of the approaches I use. I actually also integrate acceptance and commitment therapy and humanistic approaches. And what I wanted to say, though, in cognitive behavioral therapy, this process of really conceptualizing and coming up with a plan is made very explicit in therapy. And so, for example, I have a whiteboard, and we map out what we think is going on. You know, so the client and I are actually breaking down, and we're doing this over time, what's really happening? So this would be a client who's having relationship problems, and we're really trying to understand what are the beliefs that are running, how is she interpreting things, what emotions are coming up, what are her automatic coping strategies that aren't that helpful, what do we want to start teaching her to do, how do these feed back, and so this is part of an explicit conceptualization process. So education is also a big part. This happens in all traditions. Again, in some traditions, it's much more explicit. But you're learning about what's going on. You're learning about emotions. You're learning about your disorder. I do a lot of work in anxiety. That's really my specialty. And so, for example, I'll draw on the board something like this. If in one of the early sessions with someone with an anxiety client, And I'm going to talk to them about really what's the nature of anxiety, how to, you know, it's an evolutionary system, that it's adaptive, it's a response to threat, what's happening in the brain, what's happening physiologically, and so on. So I'll actually give them a lot of information, and part of that is to take the fear out of the anxiety, but it's also to really help the person learn how to effectively cope and really understand what's going on. Because, again, all of this is a mystery because our parents didn't teach it to us, the school didn't teach us. So, again, we get a lot of information here. So education is an important part. I think of psychotherapy as also a course on Emotions 101. So emotions have an evolutionary role. That's why we have them. They are a signal when we're feeling emotion that a core need is either being met or not being met. And the function of emotion is to strongly motivate certain kinds of behaviors. So anxiety strongly motivates escape or withdraw or freeze. Anger strongly motivates aggression, attack, assertiveness, and so on. The problem is that the emotions that we kind of categorize as negative, like anxiety, fear, sadness, guilt, shame, are really uncomfortable states. Again, they're designed to get us into action and to try to control things and fix things. And so they propel us forward in a certain way. And that's an important thing to learn because one of the skills that people learn in therapy is actually to learn to tolerate the feeling, to feel your feelings, to not run or fix or try to do something with the feelings, and to go deeper with them and to really try to understand what's going on. So we do this in session. There's a lot of attention put to emotion in session. We in some traditions, like what I do, is we explicitly teach skills to tolerate different kinds of emotional states, especially distress and anxiety, which is key to being able to choose how to respond to something rather than to just react to something. So, okay. So we talked about the Therapy Alliance and insight and education as being components of psychotherapy. Obviously, insight is probably one of the first things you thought about what the heck is psychotherapy. You know, one of the things that you learn when you come into therapy is kind of what makes you tick. You learn about kind of your relational style, your attachment style, patterns of behavior, what I would call your automatic coping strategies, sometimes called defenses, and how your history and experience have shaped these. And part of the reason that this is healing is that by just really understanding what's going on with you, it really reduces shame. It's incredibly validating. But I think the other reason that insight's important is it can motivate you to actually change things in your life. So what I like to say about insight is that it's necessary, but it's not sufficient for change. And sometimes insight itself can be very relieving and, as I said, validating, but often we need to put that insight into action. And in psychotherapy, we work a lot with thoughts and beliefs. Now, this is a little different from insight. Insight is kind of how do I work? But we, as we grow up, we develop our stories, our story about who I am, our stories about what other people are like, our stories about what's right and wrong, our stories about the world. And this is another term for this is schema. We have schemas about how everything is and how it should work, and this is what makes the world predictable. It's what makes it understandable. So this is how we understand things in our life. The problem is that often we have many schemas or beliefs that are distorted or exaggerated or a little bit black and white, or we may have evolved pretty negative views of ourselves. So the thing is that our core beliefs drive how we interpret everything happening. So right now, objectively, what's happening is I'm speaking, I'm saying words. But out there, the funny thing is, if we could see a little pop-up like this in each one of your brains, you'd be saying radically different things. You'd be interpreting, you know, one person would be like, oh, this is totally boring and it's all science. I thought we were going to get all juicy with transference. And somebody else is like, wow, this is really fabulous and blah, blah, you know, but this is driven by our beliefs and so we work with these in psychotherapy. I was just going to say that two approaches that do this pretty explicitly. One is cognitive behavioral therapy, where we map stuff out like this, and we really identify the relationship between thoughts, emotions, and behaviors in this cycle. In mindfulness-based approaches, there's a slightly different relationship to thoughts. Instead of trying to identify, and in cognitive behavioral therapy, we're actively trying to challenge distorted thinking. Mindfulness is about actually just noticing, observing, and in a way stepping back and just disengaging it, not taking the story quite so seriously, so that then you can still make choices in your life and not be ruled by how you're interpreting things. And finally, and in my opinion, most importantly, maybe not most importantly, but this is a huge part of my work, is we're very focused on behavior change. So especially in some of the traditions that I work in, there's a very explicit process for figuring out what your current patterns are, how they're getting in the way, and what we need to do to change them. So the therapy involves testing out new behaviors, trying out new behaviors with the therapist. Like even the act of opening up and accessing sadness for somebody who has trouble doing that, that is a new behavior they're doing in therapy. We also do behavioral experiments, testing out things. So somebody who thinks that they're a loser and they're never going to get a date, well, they get some homework assignments to go out and test that out. And there's also techniques such as exposure, I'm going to say a little bit more, that are behavioral techniques that really have a profound impact on anxiety and avoidance. And so when we encourage people to try out new behaviors, it changes things in two ways. One is it enables experiential learning, right? You're not just sitting in the session and I'm saying, oh, really, you're wonderful. Everybody would want to date you. No, you go out and you actually get the data. So the other thing is that when people engage in new behaviors, that data, that evidence feeds back and starts to challenge and change some of their core beliefs, hopefully in a positive way. The other thing that we're doing behaviorally very often is actually teaching explicit skills. Some of these I've already mentioned, but skills around managing emotion and tolerating emotion, the cognitive and mindfulness skills, of relationship skills, communication, assertiveness, how to accept differences, problem solving. There's also, you know, people have sleep disorders. We teach sleep behaviors, health behaviors, and so on. But the way that we get lasting behavior change is really through deliberate practice and the creation of new habits, right? You can't do it once, and you can't just do it with your therapist, whatever it is. You know, you open up with your therapist, but you never open up with anybody else. You're actually not going to grow and change. Your relationships are not going to get better. And so there's an importance to practice in session where you have a relationship that is safe and controlled and you can test things out, but then you actually need to go out in the world and do it. And therapy can do that through homework or more informal ways in which you go out and do things and come back and process that with the therapist. But there needs to be practice. We need to create new habits of thinking and behavior. And finally, if I'm going to talk about behavior, I just want to say that this is all in the service, really, of trying to help you move towards your deepest values and where you want to go in your life, that's what this is in the service of. So that was a very brief overview of the ways that we work, some of the tools in psychotherapy. So sounds good, right? You saw the problem, why we should pursue psychotherapy. You've gotten a taste of what psychotherapy is. But it's a fair question to say, does it work? Because as all of you know, generally psychotherapy is once a week. It's time consuming. It's expensive. It asks you to do hard things. So it better be worth it, right? So I'd like to address that. So one of the ways that we can answer the question, does psychotherapy work, is through the research that's done through randomized controlled trials. And you're all probably familiar that when a drug is developed, how do you know if it's effective? You can't just give it to people and people say, oh, it's great, I feel much better. Because you don't know really whether it's the pill or it's time or it's some other effect, right? So one of the things we do in medicine is we set up a randomized controlled trial where people are randomly assigned either to if it's medicine, it's going to be the active pill versus a placebo pill, and then you're tracking outcome. Well, a few decades ago, people started to realize, gee, maybe we should do that for psychotherapy as well. So this is just kind of a graphic of a typical, what's called an efficacy trial in psychotherapy. So somebody comes in, if this is a depression scale or an eating disorder scale, or it doesn't matter what it is, an alcohol use scale, they come in high on the symptom scale. And then what you're doing is you're seeing, how does psychotherapy do versus some control group? And in the beginning, it will be basically a wait list or treatment as usual. And so you're trying to see, really, is psychotherapy better than nothing? It's better than, right? And you have to do that with a control group. And so when you get this kind of an effect, a difference, you can have some confidence that actually psychotherapy is making a difference. So when you have, there's kind of a tradition in psychotherapy that if you have two very well-designed randomized controlled trials between a particular psychotherapy treatment and a control group, and they both show the superiority of the psychotherapy, then we can say that we have an empirically supported treatment or an EST. Okay. Usually there are a lot more studies than two, but that's kind of the gold standard. That's the base that you have to jump over. But then often once a treatment gets established, it can be tested against other treatments. It can be tested against medication. It can be tested against another form of psychotherapy. There are dismantling studies that look at, are there particular aspects of psychotherapy that work? So an example, relative efficacy then would be a comparison between two bona fide treatments to see, does one win? Y'all wanted a stats lesson today, right? you come to a psychotherapy lesson talk and you get a stats lesson. I just want to, just a couple of terms, just to clarify since I'm going on. So when you get a group difference, we talk about that. Is it statistically significant? It basically means, is there, and the tradition is, a 95 or greater chance, greater probability that it did not occur by chance. So what you say is, we can be confident that there's a difference. But that doesn't tell us how big a difference it makes. And so that's where we get effect sizes, which is a standardized way of understanding the difference between the two groups. And this is kind of a convention for Cohen's D, which is one of the ways to measure effect size. So this would be, point two would be a small, that's a small difference between group means. This is a medium or moderate, and this would be a large. So this is, you need to remember this because we're going to be talking about it later. And then just to define a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis is a way of comparing lots of treatment trials and aggregating them to be able to come up with basically an aggregate effect size. That starts to make us feel a little bit more confident. It's not just one trial here, but in looking at all of them, how effective. So here's the effect size for psychotherapy in general. This is based on studies that look at multiple meta-analyses. This is actually summarized by Bruce Wempold, who's done a lot of this work. And the bottom line is that psychotherapy, which basically has an effect size of about 0.8, that's a large effect size. You're sort of like, okay, it's kind of hard to measure that. But if you just compare it to a couple of medical interventions, you start to get a little bit of a feeling, right? So aspirin, definitely, absolutely, has a significant impact on heart attack. But the actual size, how protective it is, very, very, very small. So it's a real difference, but it's a small difference. SSRI antidepressants such as Prozac or Zoloft for depression, moderate effect size, 0.3 to 0.5 in general. Medication for lower back pain, also on the moderate level, and so on. Just to kind of give you a sense here. And in terms of improvement rates, 50% improve within 7 sessions. Half get better at 14. And many people just go on to be non-symptomatic within 21. And even if someone's not coming in with symptoms per se, symptom measures are a good marker for other problems. And so this is really saying, you know, people are getting better. This is a graph of kind of the typical symptom improvement that you see in psychotherapy. So psychotherapy works. It's a big effect. It impacts symptoms, but I also, along the theme of the mind-body connection, want to say that psychotherapy doesn't just affect the mind, it also affects the brain, and this makes sense, right? This is probably one of the reasons why it works. So this is a study that I love. This is a really brilliant study. It was a series of studies, actually, by Baxter and Schwartz. And what this shows here is this is a brain of somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder. And what you see here is increased activation in the area of the brain, the right caudate nucleus, part of the basal ganglia, and also in the thalamus area. And what you see, this is before treatment. Now, if you treat the person with medication, what you see is you see this decrease in overactivity of those areas of the brain that are associated with OCD. The interesting thing is if you treat them with cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a psychotherapy, you also see this sustained change in baseline activity of the thalamus and the caudate nucleus. I think that's pretty cool, and certainly there have been a lot more studies to show this, but, you know, just like stress can have an effect on the brain and body, psychotherapy, which is a psychological intervention, can feed back and have an effect on the brain and the body. This is just another example. This is a mindfulness intervention, and by Philippe Golden, who's at Stanford and also a friend, he showed that before psychotherapy, you see this pattern. This is of activation of the amygdala, which is this area of the brain involved with anxiety and anger. And you can see there, this is actually just symbolizing kind of avoidance and then intense reactivity. After mindfulness-based stress reduction therapy, you actually see people much more willing to approach, these are actually threatening negative self-thoughts, and are much less reactive to them afterwards. Another study by my mentor, looking at how a treatment for depression also reduces pro-inflammatory cytokines, which are really problematic in, say, multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases. So again, effects on the immune system. All right. So that data that I just presented was really addressing the question, overall, is psychotherapy effective? And I hope by now you can walk around and tell people, yes, it is. The effect size is about 0.8. It affects immune function. It changes brain function. Symptom profile looks like this. Okay, that's what you need to tell your friends when they ask you why you're in psychotherapy, okay? 0.8 effect size. What that doesn't answer is the question, why? What is it about psychotherapy that's effective, right? I gave you a description of kind of what we're trying to do in psychotherapy, but it's a different question. What is actually, you know, what is predicting outcome? And I want to say before going into this section that the truth is that we have a lot of data about how certain treatments are effective. We actually have very, very little data about how the person is changing, what are some of the factors within psychotherapy that really predict outcome. So to me, this is kind of the Wild West. There's a lot of data, and I'll show you this now, that we can say that there are a lot of treatments that are effective, but why is a little bit more of a mystery. So here are some of the big categories of research as to what makes psychotherapy effective. So, as I mentioned here, and where I'll start, one of the things that makes psychotherapy effective is the particular treatment or approach, or, right? So that's what all those randomized control trials were. And I want to talk a little bit about that. This is the main thing that our field has been researching. It's like the question has been, well, is psychotherapy effective? Okay, which treatments are effective? And I can tell you now, we know a lot about what treatments are effective. And the bottom line is that most treatments that are bona fide treatments are effective to some degree. And so this is good. And this is why you get that aggregate effect size of 0.8, right? That's across all treatments and approaches. So I want to talk a little bit about that. But there are other factors that actually get a lot less attention. And that is, there's certainly a lot of research talking about how the therapeutic alliance actually predicts outcome. There's a little bit of research on client effects, and that's probably no surprise, just the idea that, of course, what you bring to therapy probably makes a difference. But there, you know, it's not as researched. And there's also data to say that deliberate practice and giving homework in psychotherapy is effective, and also monitoring progress and the therapist has an impact. So I want to talk about each of these. So we have now had three decades of research looking, first establishing just whether a treatment is effective versus control, but then, you know, over time trying to get effect sizes for different treatments, comparing them to others. And the truth is, what all of that data says, and there's been some really brilliant summaries of meta-analyses, has shown is that, you know, for many disorders, most treatments work. And that's good news, right? You walk in and, you know, in some ways, well, I'll say a little bit more about where treatment may matter, but overall, you're probably in good hands. Let me just say, however, that the effect sizes do vary a little bit for different treatments for different disorders. And so that's an enormous literature, which I cannot review here. And in fact, it's hard to find review paper. Even just all the treatments for one disorder, it's an enormous amount of literature. So I'm going to be giving you the big picture. But let me just say, the fact that we do have so many empirically supported treatments that are better than control and tells you actually that whatever it is that all these different approaches have in common has powerful curative effects, right? It's not that every one of these is doing something totally different and then and miraculously they're all coming up with the same findings, right? There may be different mechanisms of change, but there's also some common mechanisms of change. Let me also just say that in this literature, some approaches have been studied more. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a great example. It came out of a research tradition. You get that training. I got that training, you know, at sort of research-oriented universities. All the early studies were CBT studies. There's just an enormous amount of data. And so CBT basically has enormous amount of support, but that's partly because it's been studied more. If other approaches have less data, it may mean that they just have been studied less, or it may mean they're less effective. It's sometimes hard to tell. But what I want to do is give you a big picture on depression and anxiety disorders, since these are two of the biggest categories of problems that people struggle with. So you can see that the bottom line for depression is, it's a quote by the dodo bird in Alice in Wonderland. It is, "All have won and all must have prizes." And this was the dodo bird's comment when Alice wanted to have a race and everybody just ran off in different directions. But the idea is that, so this is kind of a good example study. This is a study I worked on with my mentor. It is comparing two bona fide treatments for depression. One was cognitive behavioral therapy. The other was supportive emotion-focused therapy. It was actually delivered by telephone, so it was a telephone treatment. And what you see here is sort of, this is the end of treatment right here. And what you can see, actually, at the end of treatment, CBT wins over EFT. So you get this, but here's what's important in a treatment trial is that you also, once this treatment stops, you want to track over time what happens during follow-up. And what happens in follow-up is basically people in both treatments continue, you know, in CBT they maintain their gains and they continue to get better in the EFT group. So in the end, they're actually comparable at follow-up. And this, in the early days when cognitive therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy were the most studied, you know, the research community could say with some confidence, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy is the most effective treatment for depression. But as we have studied over and over again, almost every approach to depression is effective. And so in enormous meta-analyses, you just find that you can really seek treatment from any kind of a therapist, any approach for depression, and they tend to be equally effective. And that's important. But when it comes to the anxiety disorders, there's actually a little bit of a winner. And so the data does suggest that treatments that use exposure, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, and all the specific therapies underneath that, do tend to be more effective for anxiety. And I want to say a little bit about this, because this is a pretty important finding. It's my area. It feels important to me. So one of the things that we actually know, not from the psychotherapy literature, but from fundamental research, both animal research and human research, is that one of the mechanisms by which we develop anxiety or fear of certain situations or things is through classical conditioning. And we have an area of our brain, the amygdala, that's designed to remember frightening situations and all of the cues associated with them. So, you know, if you are on a bus and that bus gets into an accident, your amygdala is going to remember everything about that, the person sitting next to you, the time of day, the bus, the area of town, cars being in accidents. It's going to remember everything. And that's one of the ways that we learn what's dangerous in the world. So there's this ongoing, constant process of conditioning, either big conditioning or little conditioning. And a lot of anxiety is linked to conditioning. It interacts also with what we actually learn. We may learn that something is dangerous, like riding a motorcycle, having never been on a motorcycle. You know, you may know that and have some anxiety from the knowledge, but it also comes from this experience. So you can create phobias very quickly in animals by just doing classical conditioning. And they used to do that with humans way back before the ethics committees stepped in. So the question is, once that part of the brain, this is not a conscious part of your brain, this is part of your limbic system, learns something, it holds on to it. You're not going to unlearn that anxiety unless you have a new experience, unless you learn that that situation or that thing is not dangerous. And so what happens is that through, again, fundamental research, they realize that if you expose the subject to the feared object, whatever it is, it's a snake or it might be taking somebody back onto the bus. If you do that and you keep them in the situation, their anxiety is really high, but you keep them there long enough that their brain starts to see nothing bad is happening anymore, their anxiety starts to come down. They habituate in the situation. And then you do that repeatedly. That is how we unlearn conditioning. That is one of the most powerful mechanisms of change for anxiety. And so exposure therapy is based on that. It is based on exposing people to the things that they fear. Its technical term is extinction of the conditioned fear response. And one of the most important impact that has is that the things that we're anxious and we're afraid of, we avoid, and that may get in the way of our life and have a big impact on what we do and our choices. And so to be able to overcome that anxiety and overcome that avoidance is a pretty profound change for people in their lives. So the approaches that have really developed this have been behavior therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. But let me just say that exposure is also happening in other forms of therapy. So when you're really afraid to experience an emotional state and your therapist encourages you and creates a safe space for that, that's a form of exposure, and you're doing it and you'll be anxious, but then as you do it, you will start to see that it's okay. Oh, I can feel my feelings. I'm competent to feel my feelings. Oh, this person is not going to think I'm weak. Oh, she still cares about me. there's a learning experience that happens, and the amygdala is literally learning, oh, okay, I can do this. So it happens informally in your life and in psychotherapy as well, but there are just some approaches that really do it in a very structured way. And that's why I think CBT tends to win in the competition of what's the most effective treatment for particularly these anxiety disorders, especially obsessive compulsive disorder, panic disorder, and phobias, and to a certain extent PTSD as well. So there are many people here tonight who have some of these issues, and it's just important to know there's a really, really effective treatment for that, and that's a really hopeful thing. I just wanted to give an example with panic disorder of like sort of, you know, the summary of the treatment, some of the treatments. So there have been, you know, so a lot of, you know, a lot of the treatments are cognitive behavioral therapy versus control, establishing efficacy, but a lot of them have been comparative trials against other approaches. And CBT even beats medication for panic disorder as well. So again, this is a disorder that is 3% of the population. It's where people have spontaneous panic attacks and they worry about anxiety and they avoid situations. They develop agoraphobia. It's a very impairing disorder. And there is a really effective treatment for it. So that was talking a little bit about specific approach or treatment. But these are important too. So let me say, when it comes to therapeutic alliance, so this is the therapy bond and shared goals and shared plan, there is very, very robust evidence that the quality of the therapy alliance predicts how well you will do in psychotherapy. This is actually really important. This doesn't have to do with any specific approach. This is across approaches. And let me just say here, there's been a lot of criticism of this research because people will say, well, maybe people start to get better and then they like their therapist more because of that, right? It's a, you know, in a lot of these studies, it's basically, it's a correlation. You can't conclude causation from correlation. But there have been studies that have controlled for early change and found that the early therapy alliance, the nature of that relationship, reliably predicts outcome. So there's a bottom line with this, right? If you're in therapy, you better be feeling it with your therapist. You better feel like you're on the same page. You better feel like it's a good match. And as a therapist, I have to say, I'm thinking about that too. If early in the therapy, me and the client are not clicking, there isn't that bond, we're on a, you know, their conceptualization of what's going on and how they need to change is really different from mine, I know that that predicts a poor outcome. I'm probably going to refer that client if I can't get on the same page. And that's what I should do because they might actually do well with another therapist. So clients also bring their stuff to therapy. And there's been certainly research on stages of change. How ready are you for change? How motivated are you to do the work of psychotherapy? So that is one of the factors. Clients who are higher, who are further along in their readiness for change and highly motivated, do, not surprisingly, do better in psychotherapy. Hope that the therapy is going to work and expecting that it would work is also a curative factor. What does this sound like? I hear in the placebo effect, which placebo doesn't mean that it's an imaginary effect. It's a real effect, right? It's so real that every drug study has a placebo, right? Like hope and positive expectancy has physical and psychological effects. It's a big effect. I think it has an effect size of something like 0.3. So that's actually important, and that kind of goes back to the alliance, right? If you believe in your therapist and you feel like you're working well together, you're going to have more hope and you're going to believe you're going to change. And that affects outcome. So engagement and an ability to learn, to have new experiences. You know, some people come in and they want to change, but they don't really want to think differently. They don't really want to do anything differently. They kind of come in, they fold their arms, and they're like, make me better. And it's not going to work, right? Because the client has a huge power. I mean, you're the ones who actually do it, right? We're, in some sense, you know, we're your warm, empathetic coach. I also just want to say, this goes back to my point, that we have to be encouraging work outside of the session, and there is research to support that homework in psychotherapy predicts outcome. Now, why would that be? I've already just mentioned the need for deliberate practice and the creation of new habits. There's also a whole literature called the expertise literature on how people really develop expertise at different things like chess and swimming and mathematics. And, how do people really get better at whatever it is they're trying to do? They have to have clear goals, and they have to be actively practicing new behaviors. And they have to be shooting for that, and they have to be doing it over and over and over again, right? So that sort of suggests it's not enough to just do it in the therapy room. You got to be doing it outside. I also like to say that there's a physiological explanation for this. You know, your old habits have very well-worn neural pathways. If you're going to change something in a lasting way, you have to not only lay down some new neural pathways, you have to drive over them over and over and over again. That's how we create a new habit. So this is laying down and strengthening neural pathways in the brain. And it is associated with better outcome. That, by the way, was a typical, that would be like a typical homework list for one of my clients. So, feedback and progress monitoring. So, in all those randomized controlled trials, those were examples of how differences between group means, right? This group of people who got this treatment did better than this control group. What that doesn't tell you is the individual who's in my room, who's in my session, are they getting better, right? So randomized controlled trials, they're not individualized. You know, they're clients that are picked for generally one disorder, so they exclude everybody who has multiple disorders. You know, they're very clean. But the person who comes into our office is a messy human being with probably complicated things going on, subthreshold depression, a little anxiety here, they got some relationship problems, they're drinking a little too much, they don't meet criteria, like, right? They've got their strengths, they've got their weaknesses. And one of the things I want to know is this client getting better? And so one way to do it is to use traditional outcome measures, which is what they use in psychotherapy, in randomized controlled trials. You take a symptom measure, so I might measure anxiety and depression and see how that's changing over time with my client. But also you want to measure some of these other things that we know affect outcome, like the therapy alliance, how homework completion, but also I often include measures about the thing that I'm trying to target in therapy, what I'm trying to change. Maybe it's a belief, maybe it's a more specific behavior, maybe it's the size of the person's support group, maybe it's how easily they can access emotions in session. I'm going to be tracking what's happening with the client. And what the research shows is that when therapists get feedback about how their clients are doing, and this research is on outcome feedback, it improves outcome. So why would that be? So you want to do it because the research says it's helpful. Let me just say that. But I think you can kind of understand why. I mean, the truth is that, like, I have this client right now who, he's fabulous. He's, like, really psychologically minded, and he's really motivated, and he comes into session, and the hour goes like this, and we're, like, we're doing this fantastic work together, and, like, if any of my colleagues would say, you know, how's your therapy going? I might say, oh, I've got this client. He's doing great. But what's interesting with this client is I'm also measuring outcome and a couple of the mechanisms that I think is maintaining his anxiety and depression, one of them being, say, is perfectionism, perception of harm, some other things. And so we've been working for 6 months, and when I look at his measures, he is not getting better. He loves me. He's like, we're having the best therapy time, right? He could be in therapy forever, but he's not getting better. Like, it's not working. And if I didn't have the measures, I wouldn't know that, right? That's part of what I'm saying is that, you know, we therapists, we do this because we care, because we want to help. We want to believe the person's getting better. If they're coming in and they like us, we think they're getting better. You know, it's like we have our biases. We want to see that that's happening. And, you know, the other thing I'll say is that we also start with a conceptualization of what we think is happening and how we want to work. And this is a cognitive bias in all human beings. We get stuck in our initial way of looking at it, and then we just keep trying to confirm that over and over. It's called confirmation bias. We do it, everybody does it. So you need something outside of you to indicate, you the therapist, that in fact people are changing. And as an outcome measure is basically a measure of distress. You know, if they're changing, if they come in and they want their relationships to improve, if their relationships are improving, their distress will go down. I mean, it's a good marker or barometer of how your client's doing. So this is just a couple example. This is a form that a few of us developed. I want to acknowledge Jackie Persons here, Janie Hong. We developed this. It started off just as a homework form, but what I was interested in is I was sort of measuring aspects of alliance, and then the form sort of evolved. But basically, this is a form that a client comes in, and at the end of session, we write down the homework, and they fill this out, and one of the things it says is, what do you want to remember from this session? Like, what's important to them? What did they learn? What do they want to hold on to? I also explicitly ask, what didn't you like? What bothered you? Right? Because I also want negative feedback, because that's important to the alliance too. If things are not working, I want to know. And we get some of these measures. And, how did you feel understood in session? How effective was the session? Was anything confusing? I'm gathering all this data from my client, right? And then they have their homework assignment, and then they indicate how helpful the assignment was, right? And part of this is like, we need to work together to find out what's working, you know, and so on. So I use this form, and I don't use it with every client. There are definitely clients who are like, not going to do it. All right, you don't have to do it. Or they're like, you can write down my homework, but I'm not filling out the rest. Like, all right. But it works with a lot of my clients. And this is an example. This is probably one of my most common outcome measures. It's called the DAS. It's the Depression, Anxiety, Stress Scale. It's 20 questions for many of my clients who come in and are elevated with anxiety and depression. I'll have them fill it out right before they come in every week. And so what we're doing is we're tracking. So here, this is a client of mine, came in. These are elevated. This is the stress scale, the depression scale, and the anxiety scale. Came in pretty depressed, moderate anxiety, high. They're actually on different relative scales, but and pretty stressed. And this is kind of the pattern you want to see, that over 24 sessions, anxiety and depression in the normal range, stress here has been normal range, but you can see actually that this is somebody who goes through periods of stress. But at least a couple of our target things have moved down into the right area. That's helpful. And by the way, sometimes clients will be convinced that they're not getting better. They're like, oh, I feel that nothing ever changes. And, you know, you pull this out and you're like, really? Look at this. Wow. And like, I'll have them look at what they filled out at the beginning and what they filled out. Wow. They've like forgotten actually how distressed they were. So it can be helpful too in that way. So finally, the therapist has an effect on outcome. And that may seem obvious too, kind of like the client has an effect on outcome. It's like, I think everybody, you know, they're like, who do you recommend? You know, who's the best out there who does, you know, eating disorders or who does, you know, personality disorders, whatever. I think, you know, we sort of know, of course, there's going to be differences between therapists. I have to say that this is an area of research that's pretty minimal. I don't think we know a whole lot about what makes therapists better, but here's what we do know. This is a couple of studies at large counseling, university counseling centers with hundreds, maybe actually thousands, Candon, thousands of therapists. This is a big, big sample size. And what you see is they have the clients fill out outcome measures, and they if you look at the therapists with the lowest outcome scores across all their clients and those with the best, you see these enormous differences. There really are some therapists who are reliably bringing down symptoms, and other therapists that not only are the person not getting, not improving, they're actually getting a little bit worse. And you can imagine how this is. If you're not getting better, you're going to start to get demoralized, right? And you're like, here you are in therapy, and that's not even working. So let me just say that it's a hard job being a therapist, so I sort of want to say that. Again, here's one of the things that we know. Years of experience is not related to therapist effectiveness. I have to say that's kind of discouraging for some of us who go out and get more and more training. Like I feel like I'm getting better and better. But and maybe I am. Maybe what's happening is some therapists they learn how to do it and then they just kind of do the same thing forever. Maybe some of us are working hard to constantly improve and learn. We don't really know, but basically, experience is not correlated with outcome for therapist effects. By the way, it's not correlated for doctors and their outcomes either. Just an FYI. Except actually in surgery, I think and you can see why, right? So this is some of the stuff I think about. This is kind of a summary of what we went over. So it is a complicated job. I think therapists have different models and things that they take into account. You know, I'm trying from what someone comes in with a problem. I'm thinking, what are the empirically supported treatments I want to draw from? I'm also thinking about fundamental research in other areas. I'm thinking about how do I make a good alliance, good goals, make sure I do homework. There's also some research that flexibility is important with therapists. I'm monitoring progress. And I'm integrating all of this with the individual, with the client, with their goals, their values, their preferences, their history, what makes them tick, right? It's complicated. and that's how I do it. I'm every therapist, you know, is kind of putting together things. But even in the area of you know, working within one tradition, you know, you could, you know, it's a lot of work to become really, really good at any one approach. So it's a challenge. I want to sort of end here with the American Psychological Association's sort of their statement about what evidence-based practice in psychotherapy is. So evidence-based practice is the integration of the best available research with clinical expertise in the context of patient characteristics, culture, and preferences. It's a tall order. I'll say for some of my friends in the audience who are psychotherapists out there that it is hard, but we love what we do. It's a total privilege what we do. And it's been really great to be able to share some of that with you today. Thank you. So we actually have time for 15 minutes of questions. I know it looks like some people need to go. And then afterwards, if you have other questions, I'm happy to stick around.
Yes.
Okay, so the question was, how do you choose an effective therapist, and how do you know sort of their general outcomes?
Their stats.
You know, they're only now starting to collect the stats on in the medical field, and they're really, there is no way to know. What's that?
Yelp.
So Yelp and the online stuff, I have to say that's not probably a reliable way, right? Because probably the most likely thing is you get one disgruntled client who writes a terrible review of you, or somebody who loves you, and that doesn't, you know, that doesn't really say, right? How do you pick it? So I think I would say a couple of things. I mean, if you've got depression, you can go to somebody with any from any tradition, right? I would say that if you have an anxiety disorder, you probably want to look for somebody who does cognitive behavioral therapy, or at least integrates that into their approach, maybe some of the other behavior therapies as well. You want to look at someone who's good at establishing an alliance, right? You want somebody who's working with you. Like, if it's not working, they're going back to the drawing board with you, right? And so they're flexible. They're willing to say, wow, I'm not doing a good job, or this isn't working, right? So those are some of the things that come to mind. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so psychotherapy with children, first of all, I work with adults, so I'm going to say that it's not really my area. There are studies with children that look at different treatments, but it is complicated, right? Often they're not motivated, or they didn't choose, and that's one of the things that makes work with children much more challenging, I think. But there is data on that certain treatments for different problems. Just for example, one of the most common problems are like behavioral problems, ADHD, conduct disorder, acting out. And again, there's a lot of research to support behavioral interventions for those problems, right? So that might be an example. Does that answer your question? Okay. Hi, right here. She says she has a high respect, and yet her question is, she's really asking, have there been treatment studies comparing psychotherapy to talking to your friend every week? You know, there haven't, but there should be. You know, I actually think that is really helpful, and I think people know that intuitively. Right? It is helpful, especially if that person is willing to really listen, especially if they're willing to make space. Here's something, though, that people who are not trained professionals don't do well. You're my friend, and you say, oh my God, I'm really struggling with this. The instinct is to say, let me tell you how to fix it. Have you tried this? Have you done this? Have you done this? What about this? Have you tried this? You know, try this herb, drink this, go do that, right? The fix-it impulse is there, and that's because when someone comes to you with distress, It makes me distressed, and then I want to fix it. Okay? And actually, a big part of training in psychotherapy is overcoming that urge and learning to be like, tell me more about how suicidal you are. Tell me how bleak the world looks to you. Tell me how you are sure. You know, it's like, let's make that space. And people really need that. So that's actually just one difference. And then, of course, a friend is not going to have all the training and all of the other things that we do. And it's complicated with a friend because when you're talking to a friend, there's a mutual relationship. You're also going to be sort of taking care of their feelings, and you're not going to want to reveal too much that then, like, maybe they're going to change their view of you. And you do, there's all this stuff you don't have to worry about. Oh, a stranger. Well, the stranger on the bus. Well, yes. Yeah, that piece is taken away with the stranger. Yeah. Okay, question is, what about length of therapy or closure? So many of the treatments that have been studied have been short-term treatments, short-term being generally 3 to 6 months. And many of them are very, very effective. It depends a little bit on the issue. A typical treatment for panic disorder, you know, very often if it's a sort of a pure panic disorder, 3 months, they're better, right? But they come in and it's complex relationship issues and chronic depression, it's going to be longer term. But all of these approaches have short-term treatments that really try to accelerate that work. But one of the ways, what's helpful is actually to set goals and have a time frame that you're working on. Even with my long-term, I have clients I've seen for 7 years. But part of what we're doing is we set goals and work within that and see where we are, and then we'll set new goals. And this is, you know, these the few of my longer-term clients, they've got multiple problems. It's lifelong. But we're making active progress towards specific things, and that's part of what makes it work. It's not just like they're just coming in every week, right? So I think if it's longer term, you need to have that frame, those goals, that kind of thing. But short-term therapy for many problems is very effective. So about closure, it's interesting. I think that, you know, sometimes the client comes in and thinks, hey, I'm feeling better. I'm kind of wanting to wrap up. Sometimes the client keeps coming in and I'm like, I think you're better. I think we should be wrapping up. Or we need to be setting goals. Like, what are we working on here? Because, I think it's really driven by the goals. And, you know, definitely some people find therapy valuable as, you know, who are in therapy off and on their whole life and get a lot out of it and want to stay. And, you know, I've got a couple of those as well. And, you know, as long as there's a clear understanding what it is that we're doing. And then when you're wrapping up therapy, I think there's a whole process for doing that and to try to really make sure that that's mutual. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.